Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. I'm Lata Krishnan, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, chair of the American India Foundation, and your chair for today. This program is also being held in association with the American India Foundation. And now it gives me immense pleasure to introduce the speaker for this evening, author Gurcharan Das. After Harvard Business School, Gurcharan had an illustrious career with Procter & Gamble, led P&G India, and went on to becoming managing director at P&G Worldwide. In 1995, he took on another avatar. He became a full-time writer, public intellectual, and commentator. He is best known for his two bestsellers, India Unbound and The Difficulty of Being Good. India Unbound was published in a dozen languages and also filmed by the BBC. He writes a regular column for The Times of India and periodical articles for The New York Times, Financial Times, Foreign Affairs, and Newsweek. Today, Gurcharan will talk about his latest book, India Grows at Night, A Liberal Case for a Strong State. In this book, Gurcharan eloquently talks about how India historically had a strong society and a weak state, and why the need of the hour is for India to have a stronger state. He's also a dear friend, and I'm extremely proud that he's recently accepted an invitation to become an ambassador for the American India Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mr. Gurcharan Das.
Thank you, Lata, for that generous welcome. And you do me honor by inviting me to this wonderful place. I mean, this is very special. The oldest speaking society in America, more than 100 years old, and with a motto, unleashing the truth. What could be more exciting? Let me begin this evening with a story of two towns, both on the outskirts of Delhi, the nation's capital, India. 25 years ago, Faridabad, which is one of the two towns, was considered the future. It had an active municipality, it had an industrial estate, investment was pouring in, rich agriculture, a direct connection to the nation's capital, and a state government that was determined to showcase Faridabad as the future of its state as well as of India. At that time, 25 years ago, there was a sleepy village next door called Gurgaon. It had no industry, no municipality, pitiable agriculture, rocky soil, even the goats ran away. Today, 25 years later, Gurgaon is India's future. It is the engine driver of the Indian economy. It has 32 million square feet of commercial space, which houses the world's largest corporations, 27 shopping malls, 7 golf courses, and thousands of fabled apartments. Whereas Faridabad today is still groaning under the weight of red tape, official extortion. So what happened? Well, Gurgaon's disadvantage turned out to be an advantage. It had no government. So that meant no red tape, no one to stop the energy of the people to create something very special. And so the self-reliant citizens who came to Gurgaon, they, since there was no electricity, they put in generators. Since there was no public water, they dug bore wells. Since there were no public schools, they put up private schools. Private schools, even in the slums, which cost $4 a month in terms of fees, and similarly for health care and other things. So Gurgaon is in some ways the new India in a microcosm. It is a story, the new India is a story of private success and public failure. And people in Gurgaon, when they get together over a cup of chai, they say India grows at night when the government sleeps. And they ask, why do we need a government at all with corrupt politicians and unresponsive bureaucrats? Now, to rise without a state is a brave thing, is courageous. But is it wise? Is it sustainable? And shouldn't India grow during the day? And wouldn't Gurgaon be better off with a functioning drainage system, roads without potholes, nice sidewalks, parks, public libraries, a functioning public transport system? And wouldn't... So therefore, both corrupt Faridabad and entrepreneurial laissez-faire Gurgaon are not the right models for either India's future governance or any country's future governance, despite what the Tea Party movement will have you believe. Faridabad would be happier with less corruption, and Gurgaon would be happier with functioning services. And so would the new India. It shouldn't take us 10 years to build a road in India when it should take you 3. And I'm not talking about China, where it takes only 1 year. It shouldn't take us a dozen years to get justice in the courts, when it should take 2 or 3. And so this is why I wrote the book, India Grows at Night. Now, in the title, I did not complete the full sentence because I thought that might be too insulting. But I make on the cover, the subtitle of the book is A Liberal Case for a Strong State. Now, what is a strong liberal state? First of all, don't worry, don't let the word strong put you off. We're not talking about Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany. A strong liberal state is exactly what was in the minds of your founding fathers in America, as well as the founding fathers, our founding fathers in India. A strong liberal state has 3 pillars. One, it has an executive which is capable of quick, determined, decisive action when required. That action is bounded by the rule of law. That's the second pillar. And the third pillar is that it is accountable to the people. Unfortunately, these 3 pillars do not sometimes reinforce each other like the pillars in this building. They undercut each other. Too much obsession with accountability weakens the executive as we have found in recent years, with this anti-corruption movement in India, and even in the United States, you find President Obama is in a weak position. He cannot take through his health care bill. So it's not just a problem only with India, but many democracies face this problem. And to some extent, I would blame the discipline of political science, which has been so obsessed for the last 100 years with accountability that it has forgotten why the state was created for collective action, for the ability to get something done. And nobody, if 90% of the political scientists are studying accountability, hardly anybody is studying the problem of state capacity to get things done, which is what we created the state for. So, coming to India, it's been the same thing. For the last 65 years, everybody's been obsessed with accountability. And therefore, the fact is that we do not have the capacity. The functions of the state have multiplied, but the capacity of the state has not grown. And this is really why we need a reform of institutions, the reform of the bureaucracy, the police, the judiciary. And the present economic slowdown in India may well reflect that we have hit a wall, and it may be because of this. So, what is to be done? And how will we create a strong liberal state? And let me just once again remind you that it's not just, don't think it's problem only of India. Europeans have, their single biggest problem is how to pay for their social welfare, for health care. They haven't been able to come up with an answer. The U.S. deficit, struggled for decades with the U.S. deficit, and you haven't got an answer. So clearly, this is a problem affecting. Now, before I try to come up with some kind of answer, I think it's worth stepping back to ask, what kind of society is India, where we need to do these reforms? And it will tell us how easy or difficult such a reform is. As I said, India is a bottom-up success, unlike China, which is a top-down success. China's success has been orchestrated by an amazing technocratic elite, a technocratic state which has built extraordinary infrastructure. We have never seen that happen so quickly. India's success has been orchestrated really, I mean, it's like spontaneous. It is from below and almost despite the state. And that's why India's success is reflected in 25 globally competitive companies that it has created in the last 2 decades, of which at least 3 or 4 will become names that you will recognize in a few years, the way you recognize Samsung and Sony and other global names. I have a Chinese friend who invests in India's stock market. And he comes and visits me periodically, although he hasn't come home recently because he says, I suspect he thinks I gave him some bad stock tips. One day he came home with a backache. And I said, what happened? He said, your roads. He'd been going to the rural areas looking at factories in Haryana. And he said, how could you become the second fastest growing economy in the world with roads like these. So I told him India grows at night. And he thought for a while. And then he said, you mean India has risen with one hand tied? And I nodded. And he said, you know, the nightmare of the Chinese leadership should be, what if that second hand got untied one day? The mistake we make when we compare India and China and ask who will win the race between these two countries is we think who will get rich first. Both countries are going to turn middle-income countries in a decade or two. But then they're going to get stuck. They think that their destiny is to reach $40,000 per capita income of the United States. But that's not going to happen. The race between these two countries is whether India will fix its governance first or China will fix its politics first. And if they don't fix that, both will get stuck in what economists call the middle-income trap, which is what Latin America was stuck in for decades. The other mistake we make is to believe that India has just become a weak state recently because of coalition politics, because of a weak prime minister and a gridlock in parliament. No, India has always been a weak state and a strong society, whereas China has always been a strong state but a weak society. And the fact is you need both a strong state and a strong society, a strong state to get things done, and a strong society to make that state accountable. So India's history was a history of kingdoms competing with each other, fighting with each other. China's history was a history of empires. In China, the emperor gave the law and interpreted the law. In India, the law, meaning dharma, preceded the king, and the job of the king was to uphold dharma for the sake of the people, and the interpreter of dharma was not the king, but the Brahmin. So very early on in 6th century BC in the kingdom of Magadha, you had created a liberal division of powers which weakened the state, as we can see even today. So the fact is oppression in China always came from the state. Oppression in India never came from the state, but from society, from the Brahmins. And the answer to that oppression was the Buddha, or a spiritual entrepreneur that we call Guru, who comes around every few years and you know, saves the people. So if the Chinese are assimilators, Indians are accumulators. The people who peopled India were the same, in many cases, people who peopled China. In other words, these people came from, these were migrations from Central Asia. In China, they assimilated them into one Han identity. In India, we accumulated them into 2,200, what we call subcastes, jatis. And so the Chinese are like a soup, and we are like a salad, where we can see the different identities. Or if you like Indian cooking, you can say biryani. We are like a biryani. And so in 1947, India could only have become a democracy. And China typically became a totalitarian state. And now India is rising from below and China from the top. This gives an idea of where we are both coming from. And on this basis, it's worth asking what is to be done. Well, if we are lucky, we'll have a strong leader. But in a democracy, you can't guarantee that. But democracies have had strong leaders. India had, UK had Margaret Thatcher. In India, we had Indira Gandhi. Unfortunately, Indira Gandhi was the wrong kind of strong leader. She was a destroyer of institutions, we need a builder of institutions. There's no silver bullet as the answer. The hope really lies in the new middle class in India, which has come up in the last 20 years. India is a very young country. Half the people are below 25. And about a third of India has now tasted success. And these people, and this will become half of India by 2020. These are both the middle class and those aspiring to be part of the middle class. This is not a car-owning middle class, by the way. A scooter-owning middle class would be more like it. But these people have been awakened by the Anna Hazare movement and these various corruption, anti-corruption movements and protests. But to be awake is not enough. The hard work of politics is what we need to do now. So I get the opportunity to address these young people, at least two groups in a week, ever since my book came out. And they ask me, what should they do? And I tell them that learn from the United States. There was a man called Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, who came to this country in 1830s. He wrote the best book on democracy. He told the Europeans why Americans were successful in their democracy. And the reason lay in neighborhood engagement. So I tell them, don't worry about the corruption of the politician who's been caught with a bribe in Delhi. Worry about corruption in your neighborhood. And the mantra, I tell them, is 1 hour a week. Spend 1 hour a week on your neighborhood. The second thing I talk to them about is tell them that there's a code word. Many countries have a code word which basically unlocks the secret of that country. Now, the code word for the United States is liberty. All the good and bad things that are done in the name of liberty in this country. The code word for France is égalité, equality. And they do the craziest things in France, including a 35-hour week and a 70% tax rate on the rich, in the name of égalité. Now, the code word for India is dharma. And I wrote a book on this. I'm not plugging that book. But essentially, dharma means doing the right thing. There's a duty that the king has, the Raja Dharma, that state has a duty to its citizens. And what people today in these corruption scandals talk about is this, they say, especially since I write for the language newspapers in India, the word they use in headlines day after day is Dharma has been wounded in our country. And so we need to inculcate what Tocqueville called the habits of the heart. Unfortunately, nobody sold the Constitution. In America, you're obsessed with your Constitution. You sell it every day to the people. In India, people think that Dharma sort of fell from heaven one day. And nobody, the last person who talked the language of Dharma was Gandhi, and he died right after independence. Nehru tried to sell it, but Nehru was too much of a westernized elite, and he did not resonate with the people. And so Gandhi fought for equality against untouchability in the name of Dharma. He did the same when he fought against the British. And so we need to recover this code word, and we need to translate the Constitution in the language of Dharma. Whereas the Constitution builders actually were imbued with the fact that they were on a Dharma project. They, in fact, put the wheel of Dharma in the flag of India. Unfortunately, we have only a flag of United States here. We don't have a flag of India. But some of you will remember that in the middle of the flag is the wheel of Dharma, what we call the Ashok Chakra, to remind people that there is a duty of the state. Finally, the third need is that people have got the impression that India has risen through these economic reforms, but they believe that these reforms have made the rich richer and the poor poorer. Nobody has bothered to sell the idea to the people that actually there's a difference between being pro-market and pro-business. They think it's all about being pro-business. Pro-market means you stand for competition. Competition lowers your costs, lowers prices, improves products, and helps everybody, and leads to a rules-based capitalism. Pro-business means that the government still retains power to give licenses to their friends, and this leads to crony capitalism. So people have not distinguished between rules-based capitalism and crony capitalism. And hence, what I believe is that we need a true liberal party, a country which gives so much economic liberty to its people, gives so much religious liberty, so much political liberty, but yet has so much difficulty giving economic liberty to its people. Well, I've been pretty critical of the situation so far, but let me end by telling you that this book of mine was actually born in Tahrir Square in Egypt, where I was invited by the democracy movement to speak about the India model for the future of Egypt's democracy. And the Egyptians asked me three questions. They said, one, how did you get the generals to stay out of power? I said, for 65 years, we haven't even asked that question. And they said, you don't realize how far you've come if you'd never had to ask that question. The second question they asked was, they said, 11% of Egypt is Christian, Coptic Christian, and 13% of India is Muslim. We believe, they said, that the Christians of Egypt feel insecure, but the Muslims of India feel secure. Not only that, they said that the Muslims of India are the least fundamentalized, radicalized, Islamicized Muslims in the world. So how did you do that? Again, I said, I never thought of India as a great secular model. We've had our Hindu-Muslim riots. We had in Gujarat 2002, Sikh riots in 1984. But they said, you're too close. You don't know how the Muslims are in the rest of the world. The third question they said was, how did you get that outsourcing business so that we can also get it and start growing our economy rapidly? Well, I mentioned these three questions to you because it did put a perspective on somebody who's very critical of the situation in India. And therefore, that's a good point to close because it puts a perspective on what we need to do, but also puts a perspective that here you are in the West and the rise of India has been the defining event of my life. While you here after the global financial crisis after the global financial, are searching your soul for what is the right model for you. A nation is rising in the East based on the classical principles of liberty, equality, the rule of law. And this has got to be something that's good for the world. Thank you.
Our thanks to Gurcharan Das, columnist for the Times of India, contributor to the New York Times, and author of the book, India Grows at Night. It's now time for our audience question period, so we have a number of questions, so let's begin. A question from Mr. Kumar asking, is it time for the system of governance in India to change from a parliamentary democracy to a more of a presidential form of governance in which the implementation and management of its economic policies are entrusted to its CEO?
Well, that's a tempting thought. But as I said, even presidential systems under a weak president can be weak, and there's a gridlock in the Congress, for example. So that's not the silver bullet. And in parliamentary democracy, you've had some very strong leaders who have reformed their governments. And moreover, our state governments, where the action really is, those state chief ministers, they work like presidents of countries. So I'm not sure that's the answer. What is the answer is what I began by saying, is the reform of our institutions. Every nation has to keep reforming its institutions.
Has the British bureaucratic system linked to feudalism been a factor in India's development? Would India have benefited instead from a US-based constitutional mandate?
No. I think that it's not a US versus Britain issue at all. And this is a question that's related to the first question. I think democracy, democracy takes time to mature. Britain was a very corrupt society in the beginning of the 19th century. As you remember, we read in our history books that you could buy a seat in Parliament, you could buy any job in the government. But they did the reforms, the reform acts. They had good leaders, Disraeli, Gladstone, and in this century, Margaret Thatcher. Most of you think of Margaret Thatcher as somebody who was a pro-market prime minister. But in fact, she had a bigger impact in making the government of Britain a lot more accountable. So I don't think it's to do with a particular model or system. A parliamentary system can work, and so can a presidential system.
I know the answer to this one, but I shall ask it. Do you think things would be better in India if women had greater power?
Well, they are increasingly getting, women increasingly have greater power. At the local level of what we call our Panchayati Raj, the law requires that one-third of the legislators at the local level are women, and one-third of the chairpersons of the local bodies are women. So today we have 1.5 million women legislators. And the women's movement also has made a big impact. India is a very, very, very vibrant civil society. Now we have a lot of problems, of course. Women, we are a patriarchal society. And as memorized, told you, a strong society, which is now changing into a strong civil society. And so this process, and women are leading this change. And yes, the answer, short answer is yes.
There seems to be a very big divide in India between rural and urban areas. How can India equate this discrepancy? Does it even need to? And I'll add a follow-on, which is, what role do nonprofits play in making India a stronger society?
Okay, but the first part of your question was...
Can you equate the discrepancy between rural and urban India, and do we really need to?
Right. Yeah, this is a cliche, Bharat versus India, India meaning urban India and Bharat meaning rural India. And, you know, India is a society in transition. A lot of people say that, why should everybody dream of coming to the cities? Why can't they be happy in the villages? Now, this is a very seductive dream of urban people. But the reality is that every child of a farmer, of a peasant, wants to go to the city and doesn't want to be a farmer. This has been true in history all along. And India is not going to reinvent a new model in this. Marx said, people prefer to be a starving proletariat than a starving peasantry. That's going to happen. So the answer is to make the cities more livable and make people find ways. And that's where the soft underbelly of India's economic model is, that it's driven by services, consumption, and by domestic market rather than by manufactured exports. And that's what we need to do, because how will we otherwise create jobs for the millions from rural to urban areas?
In your book, you talk about the distinction between soft state and oppressive state and how a soft state need not be oppressive. Is there an example you can give us, a state that India can aspire to follow? And do you think America is an example for India to follow?
Well, the soft state or the weak state that I've been talking about, the benefit of that is that oppression does not really come usually from the state in such a case. You can always fix it. You can always get things done. You can get around the state. Now, that's not the way we want to do it. I think the U.S. has been strong and weak, soft and hard at times. And the American president has the powers to really make U.S. a very determined high actions state. I'm not sure there is any one model, but I would say certainly if you take the countries of Scandinavia as an example, where you have very high levels of governance, but also very high levels of social welfare. These countries, actually, they're small, of course, but these countries are a kind of model, because I think the U.S. does not have enough welfare for its people. I mean, the Obamacare is an example where it's trying to cover at least everybody with health care.
How do you think one can bring about change in a country as hierarchical as India?
I think something like that, you know, is not something that... personally, I don't think it's a problem. A lot of people see that as the problem of being a modern country. I just think a vibrant economy, in the end, creates the competitive needs. Competitive changes people where it doesn't matter which caste you come from. You need the talent. If you are working in Infosys or TCS in Bangalore, and you need a person who performs and satisfies customers, you don't care which hierarchy that person belongs to. So the best answer against hierarchy is economic growth, and to create a modern economy through growth. So I personally, I don't worry about that. I don't lose any sleep about that.
Why are people at the helm of universities, industries, people like yourselves who are uncommon leaders, not speaking out more vigorously in India and more often?
Well, that is true. I think people need to speak out much more. It's begun to happen. And this is, again, I'm talking about the young people are setting the tone. It's social media that is setting the tone, that these people are behind the corruption movements, etc. Only now, but they need a party. They need a politics that they can be a part of. And for right now, there's only new party that's come up is called the Aam Aadmi Party. And this has come out of these anti-corruption protests. Mm-hmm. And I was just in Berkeley addressing a group of people from IITs. These are high-performing engineers who are supporting this party. And, you know, I mean, it's a good thing this party has come up. But the party is really flawed. Unfortunately, the people in that party don't even believe in the economic reforms. They want their answer to high prices is price control. Take the prices down by half overnight. Now, that's not how you build an economy.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Gurshan Das, business analyst, columnist, and author, who is discussing challenges facing India. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. What kind of changes, Gurshan, can we expect to see in the next 20 years in India? What's the worst case scenario? What's the best case scenario?
Well, the best case scenario is to throw this government out. We are sick and tired of the corruption, the incompetence of this government. Imagine dropping, it takes real talent to drop economic growth rate from 9% to 4.5%. 1% growth rate means 1.5 million direct jobs, 3 indirect jobs that direct jobs create, 6 million jobs, and each job supports 5 people. That's 30 million people are affected when you drop the growth rate by 1 percentage point. I think we need to go back to realizing why India has risen. It has risen because of reforms, and we need to go back and keep doing those reforms. To those economic reforms, we need to add institutional reforms. And these institutional reforms, the bureaucracy, the judiciary, the police that I have talked about. I think that's really the path. So the best case scenario would be to have a leadership in the country that would come in the next election, next year, which would espouse these policies, and we'll go back. I think India's economic fundamentals are too strong. When you have a 30% savings rate and investment rate in the economy, you have to be growing at 8-9%. So that will happen. And frankly,
I noticed nobody has asked the question about Narendra Modi.
I was Everybody, just about to.
Okay, well then I'll wait and have you ask that question.
Well, I was going to ask you whether you felt there were any leading candidates to lead the country, and what might you think of Narendra Modi?
Well, that's the question of the day in India, being debated every single day. You have before my last column in the Times of India 2 Sundays ago was precisely about that the people of India now have a very clear choice before them. That's good in a democracy when you have two leaders who represent real choices before the people. And they're not mouthing the same things, which confuses people. So you have Narendra Modi, who is the candidate of the opposition, the right nationalist BJP party. And he is probably the closest thing India has today to get back to 8-9% growth, purely through, he's a strong personality. And he's very clear and purposive, And he gives a very clear sense of direction to the bureaucracy. So today the bureaucracy is all gummed up. And I think he can ungum the bureaucracy at the central level. The second thing he has in his favor is that he has run a much less corrupt government than almost any government in India, his state government of Gujarat. So you can have corrupt-free governance, you can have high growth, but there is a downside. He's also non-secular. Now, I mentioned the 2002 riots, and he was the chief minister who presided over that violence. So it's choice before the voter, it's very clear. If you believe in secularism, you vote for Rahul Gandhi, the dynasty that has ruled India for 50 years, and the Congress Party. If you believe in high growth and corrupt-free governance, you vote. Now, this is an unhappy choice, but then that's what we have. We don't have perfect politicians. We have to choose between two bad options, usually.
Moving on to a topic that is of much interest to a number of people here, it would appear. How should India handle its relationship with China? And what can China, is there something that China can learn from India?
Well, China can learn liberty from India. And India can learn good, strong governance from China. India can learn how to build infrastructure from China. Now, you can never do it the Chinese way because in India, when you start to build a road, people go to court. Even if a little piece of their land is affected, they will go to court, and that slows you down. Democracy does slow you down. But these are the two fastest growing economies in the world, representing two different economic paths. And basically, both countries need reforms. If China is lucky, it could morph into a giant version of Singapore one day, at least a benign form of dictatorship. But one can never be sure. And if India is lucky, it could learn from Singapore and China that, you know, how an executive can act to get things done.
As you think about institution building and you think about the old style United Nations, NATO, that came out of World War II, what do you think future institutions should look like?
Well, this is a complex and a big question. I guess I've been concerned with institutions on the ground and not global institutions, which partly the question seems to be searching for, like United Nations, the institutions like IMF, World Bank, the Dumbarton Oaks institutions.
Is there an institution in India that one could create that would help answer some of the questions we've been asking today?
I think that these are what we need in India, are the true tried and tested institutions that have worked around the world. The best practices. Take the best practices. We used to have an expression in Procter & Gamble called search and reapply. And that's what we keep needing to do in India. Instead of thinking that we are going to reinvent the wheel, we need to keep just searching. Like I gave the example of the United States and its local engagement Now, this is one of the best practices that we can take from the United States and apply it to India. Strong, vibrant local government is really, and therefore the more power we can push down to the local government and make decisions at the local level rather than being made at the central level, I think that would be a much better way to do it. There have been very good bureaucracies in history. We can learn. I mean, why should a person in the government who works 14, 15 hours a day get the same increment, promotion, that a person who works 2 hours a day? But that's what happens in the Indian bureaucracy, which is based on the principle of seniority. We know that's stupid. I understand we cannot fire a government official, but you don't have to promote all officials on the same day, and they shouldn't all be earning the same salary, and you should have some form of recognition. Today, about 20% of India's bureaucracy keeps India afloat, and they're not recognized at all. And 80% who don't work, who don't care to work, who are corrupt, get away. These are simple institution-building things that one can learn.
India has a very strong civil society. What role do you think nonprofits can play in making this our society stronger?
That's a question that actually you'd earlier asked. And the culture, again, I think we can take inspiration from the United States, that the whole culture of philanthropy is something that's come out of this country. No country in the world has such a vibrant philanthropic spirit as does this country. And it's just as Silicon Valley inspired Bangalore and inspired our outsourcing businesses, the software businesses. So we are beginning to see the philanthropy of actually America India Foundation, something like that, where you've raised $85-90 million. Now that is beginning to also come to India. And we have a man who made money, a billionaire, software billionaire, who has just given $2.4 billion for education. Now, these are very few instances, but they're beginning to happen. And when Warren Buffett and Bill Gates came to India, there was a lot of response to them.
And do you think civil society in India, in the form of local NGOs, can build advocacy to help the government think about what is really important for the underprivileged?
Well, I mean, yes. The answer is yes. You have both kinds of NGOs, bad NGOs and good NGOs, and we constantly need to remember that. And sometimes the bad NGOs get the bad press and give a bad name to a sector. But I would say one of the good things in India is the work being done by civil society.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is only time for one last question. And if you'll do me the honor, I'll ask you a question. What changed in 1995 when you thought about going from the corporate sector to writing and being a public intellectual? And give us a little snippet of your upcoming book.
Well, I'd reached the age of 50. And I came to work one day, and I was looking after global strategy for some of the health and beauty care brands of our company. And I was looking at the market share of Oil of Olay, Pantene, and Vicks VapoRub. And I said to myself, now, how long can an adult come to work day after day and look at the market share of these products? And isn't there a bigger world outside and something else to do? And so that really was the trigger, frankly. And I had always been a weekend writer, so it helped. The transition was easy. I had written plays in my 20s. One play had got done at Off-Broadway. They had been published, performed everywhere. There was a novel I had written which had done well. Penguin had published it. So I had some confidence, and I guess that helped to make the transition. And I think the big event was that in India, the economic reforms had just come out, and the fact was that nobody was selling the reforms, and it needed somebody to be. So I became a cheerleader for the reforms and moved from writing fiction to nonfiction. And the new book, basically, I'm at Berkeley this fall semester. And I'm working on my new book. I've been lucky. We have created a reading group which has the readings which I would have read to do research on my new book. So we meet on Monday afternoons for 2 hours, and we talk about this. And the subject... You know, the classical Indian life had four aims. One of them was artha, which means material well-being. So I've written a book on that, India Unbound. A second aim of life was dharma, which means moral well-being. And I've written a book on that called The Difficulty of Being Good. So now the third aim of life is karma, which means desire. It means all desire, but particularly sexual desire. And we have a great literature in Sanskrit. Most of you know just the Kama Sutra, but there are very, very many texts dealing with this. And so I said that here's a subject that interests all of us as human beings. It's an elemental drive. And why not try to come to grips, trying to understand what is karma? So that's the subject of my next book, and that's what I'm doing.
Well, we have a few more minutes, so we can address a few more questions here. How controversial are your views considered in India, and who are your allies?
Well, the views are controversial because I support the market, and I support market-based outcomes, and I'm still a minority when it comes to that. I find it very hard to find a politician who will go in front of the public and argue in favor of market-based outcomes. Now, this is a difficult act in any democracy, because if your rival is a populist or a socialist and promises electricity at half price to people, you have no chance. You will say, oh, but we will invest in the reforms. We will increase the supply of electricity. We will create competition in the markets, like in the telecom market we created. Before that, there was only one provider. Now we have many, many providers. And I said, this is good for all. Now, this message is very hard, mainly because, as Adam Smith said, the invisible hand is invisible. You don't see it. Whereas the guy who promises electricity at half price, he can immediately say, after the election, my electricity bill will go to half. So therefore, I would say that it's a hard sell to sell the market, but it can be done. I mean, Clinton did this for the Democrats in this country. Blair Tony Blair did that in Britain, changed the move the Labour Party more towards the centre. But it's a tough sell. And so I suppose I'm pretty lonely out there.
Switching topics here, can you talk a little bit about India and Pakistan's relationship, and where do you see this going?
Well, I wrote a novel called A Fine Family, which was a partition novel, which believed in what was called the One Nation Theory, which means that India should never have been divided, and it should always have remained one country. And you should never have had problems like Kashmir and all this. Today, it's the most dangerous place in the world with two nuclear powers who are enemies. It's a very difficult question. And sometimes I wrote a column in one of my columns in the newspapers was, ignore Pakistan, heed China. I told people that don't be obsessed with Pakistan. Pakistan will just pull you down to an identity-based politics. Whereas China will inspire you to build better infrastructure and many other things. It's too late for the one nation theory. The two nations have existed for 65 years. I still believe that the answer for these two countries is to get the army out of power in Pakistan, and Pakistan should be run by civilian governments. Now it's getting there, but still the army is, and especially ISI, which is the intelligence organization, is too powerful. And finally, the fact is that the best answer for the two countries is vigorous trade. If we just traded with each other, now we have to trade via Dubai. But a new regime is coming in, and I think if the civilian government has its way, it will lead to free trade, and that will bring down some of the tensions.
Perhaps ending this evening's talk with aspirations for our youth, for our young, the next generation. What advice would you give to aspiring writers? And how can young people in India organize more cohesively? What kind of a role can social media play? You're so bullish on India. What can the youth do to reach your aspirations?
Yeah. Well, I am bullish on the youth for sure. And frankly, you have to be bullish. I mean, we are the largest democracy in the world. And democracy with governance issues, but it's still a very vibrant democracy. You have you're of a rapidly growing economy. You've got a young nation. Now, that's really the lesson of my book, India Grows at Night, is precisely for the young people now to engage in the hard work of politics. That I talked about 1 hour a week. Let's begin by spending 1 hour a week in the neighborhood, the way Americans, I hope they still do it, but they certainly did during Tocqueville's time. And certainly social media is very much a part of that engagement, because you get your friends. Now we are able to not only engage over geographies. And the difficult thing is to translate that anger that the young feel. That needs to be translated into effective politics. And I'm very glad this new party has come up. Mm-hmm. I wish this party had some sanity and could have at least believe that they need to do the hard work of reforming institutions, to do economic reforms. And that is what will solve the problem. Their straight answer is just put them in jail. Put the crook in jail. That's the answer. So that's not the way. But yes, you know, as I said, one third of India today is this new middle class. It's going to be a half of the country. So politics has to change. Has to change.
Our thanks to Gurcharan Das, columnist for the Times of India, contributor to the New York Times, and the author of the book, India Grows at Night. This program has been held in association with the American India Foundation. We also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. We also want to remind you that copies of Mr. Das's books are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign copies in this room immediately following the program. I'm Lata Krishnan, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.